Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to Hoovering, the podcast about eating. I'm Jessica Fostercue. I love eating as much as anything else in the world, but also it sometimes brings me conflict, shame, and all sorts of other things that are rubbish. It's complicated and I think fascinating. This is a conversation with an interesting soul, not just about food, but about gobbling it up, or if you will, hoovering. Hello and welcome to the Hoovering Podcast. I'm Jess. Nice to meet you. If you're new, this week's episode I would describe much in the same way as my toddler would describe a huge wave. It's a big, big whopper. First of all, I just want to thank you for listening. Thank you if you're telling other people about this podcast. If you enjoy it, please keep doing that. That's the only PR that I've got for this podcast. Rate, review and subscribe it. Tell everyone about it. And if you've got any spare dough, as in actual money wedge, I'm on a site called Patreon, where in exchange for even as tiny as $2 a month, I will give you podcast related prezzies. You had to go to patreon.com/thehooveringpod. I've finished all the admin now. Let's have a podcast. This week's guest is only a bloody massive, great big mega hero, kind lord of the food. It's Simon Rimmer, off of Sunday Brunch. I know. Get in. So a heads up, first of all, we met in a pub garden, so there is a bit of wind making a horrible noise, and sometimes a nearby child makes noise. Damn you, wind and children. And me for not having acquired lapel mics at this point. But please rest assured with my giantest promise that as annoying as it sounds for the first 30 seconds or so, it does go away and you totally stop noticing it. Solid gold promise. This is such a fascinating episode, if I don't say so myself. Simon has stories that are funny AF about guests' epic fails on Sunday Brunch. He's brutally honest about patches of workaholism, and there's a great big reveal, as far as I'm concerned, about how chefs eat and what the consequences of that can be. At one point, I say, it smells like I've been allowed to be nose right in a fire, and he's totally cool with that. What a guy. Let's go.
You do making and eating food for a living, which on paper for me is the dream. That is living a dream. Is it true? Or is it, if there's anything about it that sort of ruins it in this, and I ask it because as a comedian you get this thing which no one would ever tell you about. If someone said, oh, I'm thinking about doing comedy, there's only reason why I shouldn't, which is when you then watch comedy right through, from the best live comedy to stuff on telly or films, if you think it's amazing you go very funny, and you don't get that, like, you laugh, you still laugh, but you laugh at the stuff that was off the cuff or just a bit cliquey. I think it gets like that with food and eating.
I think initially, probably, but I mean, I've been a chef for 28 years. Yeah. I think you hit a point in the middle when, like, I sort of plateaued in my career as a chef, and you sort of go, oh God, I feel like I'm stuck in a rut with what I'm creating,
really?
What I'm doing.
And how then, many years into 28 years?
So probably probably 10 in.
Yeah.
We've got up to three restaurants. One had been really unsuccessful. We'd lost a load of money, so I was back down to one.
Right.
So we sold number two to fund the losses on number three.
Right.
So it was kind of backwards
start. It's so stressful.
Yeah, and I think then you sort of sit there and you go, I hate this industry. I hate everything about it. I hate food. Everyone's better than me. So I think then I probably had that thing of going, yeah, that's really good. I hate you for being really good. But now I find that I really, really love it. And I think one of the big things that changed was doing some of the weekend then leading to Sunday brunch. For the last 11 years, I've had to write a minimum of 3-4 recipes every single week of my life outside of having restaurants.
That is insane. 3-4 recipes a week.
So that's 11 years since I started doing some of the weekend.
Still, 11 years.
Yeah, so I think it's real to that. Then you kind of go,
because they're probably like TV chefs in the 80s, no offence to them, but who got to bring a book every 5 years out and then dine out on it, excuse
me. You watch TV food from the 80s and it's so slow. Like, I used to love the Galloping Gourmet. You're probably too young.
I can't remember it.
So, you used to get a guy called Graham Kerr, and basically, used to do in front of a live studio audience, and he used to kind of, he was a bit of an American version of Floyd, really. We'd have a few drinks, he'd cook a bit of food. And as a kid, I remember thinking, this is so exciting and fast paced. When you watch it back now, he cooks two dishes in a half hour show, one of which is basically some buttered cabbage.
Yeah.
And you feel like, oh my goodness, it's like pushing a piece of string. It's so slow, whereas now then it's far more fast paced. So I think it's because of that, then you get excited. In fact, what we got from, I've got some smoked almonds, because smoked almonds are one of the nicest things in the world.
I've also bought you a really weird thing to try.
Oh,
well, I don't know if it's weird. Yeah, it's a birthday present. It was my birthday last week and someone's brought me the World's Salt Selection by Sous Chef.
That's nice. And what salt have we got in it?
We've got some Persian blue, some black lava sea salt, which I am terrified of. I'm a big salt fan. This is why this is a gift from my friend Hal Branson, who's a lovely man, and a very funny comedian.
So here's the thing. So when I have, I love salt in food, but when I have, if I get a sea salt crystal on my tongue, it makes me gag.
Okay, we won't be trying that then.
But it's really weird. It's a recent thing.
Is it?
Yeah. And I don't
How
know.
Funny.
Yeah, and I just kind of, I just started this whole thing where I'd get a little salt crystal that just really made
you're
me
into it.
Yeah, but I like salt.
I love salt. I've had that recently with anything deep fried.
Wow, and that's terrible.
I know, it's really heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking. But yeah, if you get like just a mouthful of batter, where you get that, when you get that burst of hot fat in your mouth, which should be a thing of pure joy.
Yeah.
It makes me like.
How
makes
when
my
did
head
that start?
Back. It happened about 6 months ago, maybe less actually, maybe like 3 months ago.
Yeah, I feel like I'm your I feel like I'm giving you a grilling now. So
had
you changed your dietary habits prior to that happening?
I mean, they're always in a state of flux. I'm quite planty. I don't eat much milk and dairy.
Yeah.
I don't eat much dairy and meat, and hardly
always
any meat.
Or recently,
that's about a year and a half old.
Yeah, I reckon it's that.
Do you? It's just taste buds changing and morphing. You do adapt, don't we?
Yeah,
we're
big
so
time.
Oddly adaptable.
Yeah.
But it's plant fat, or do you think maybe there was some animal fat?
I think there's something about, I think if you embark on a plant based diet, then you naturally eat less fat.
Right.
You've got to struggle hard to kind of eat as much fat as you would eating a deep fried chicken wing.
I do try quite hard and do quite well, Simon.
But you know what I mean? So if most of your diet is plant-based, and all of a sudden
you've got like vegetarian, very successful vegetarian books and restaurants, but you're not vegetarian.
No. Well, when we started, so 28 years ago, when I decided that I was going to have a change in career and stop being a designer and become a restaurateur, then really it was the fact that what we bought was a very sort of very 1980s vegetarian calf. Which was very kind of brown, very worthy. It was very kind of like, you know, brown rice. It was no socks, it was lentils. And it was kind of like old school veggie restaurants were about what you didn't eat rather than what you did eat. But it was in a great area. So where it is, which we're still got it now in West Inch, we just started to feel a bit cool. And so when we started it, it just made sense to kind of be there. I think because I'm not a vegetarian, so I'm a business partner from that business isn't a vegetarian, we had to find a way of creating food that we wanted to eat.
Of course.
You know, because we were completely devout carnivores back then. And so little by little, as I was sort of learning my craft, you know, by the seat of my pants, I'd never been trained as a chef, then I think we just developed a way of working and making veggie foods a bit more exciting, a bit lighter, and not about kind of what you can't have. So let's celebrate what you can have.
Yeah.
And it sounds very like, you know, we were like pioneers. We weren't. I think it was just the fact that we hated everything we were making, because you'd read a veggie cookbook and it was like, under no circumstances eat anything you might enjoy. Don't eat anything that isn't brown.
Exactly. I think people have a very similar view of or certainly did until the last few years, of veganism as well. Like, you think there's got to be this carnival of misery. But you say you're not pioneers, but I think you're doing yourself down. The reviews for your book are all people going, oh, I've never had a vegetarian meal, and this is amazing. It's great.
And still 28 years in, then it's still exciting. It's still the biggest challenge as a chef, I still think, that kind of doing veggie, and particularly vegan food.
Yeah.
We're now in Greens, at the moment, we're running at about 65-70% vegan, excluding dessert.
I've really seen that, actually. Vegetarian restaurants have really up there.
Yeah, and it's about customer demands. Yeah. And I think, you know, the thing being, if you are a restaurateur, a bar owner, a pub, whatever it might be, if you ignore the requirements of your customers, then you'll die. Same in your job. Yeah, if you go and say, right, I'm going to do stand-up, but I'm only going to do about wooden fences, you might be really successful. But, and meanwhile, you're just there going, I quite like that for the first three jokes about wooden fences, but now I'm 45
turns out
minutes
I'm not
in,
that into wooden fences. You know, guest on your show, have you seen an increase there in people who are being planted?
Terrifying.
Really? Really rapid? Because it feels so quick, and it feels like it's this year. Suddenly everyone.
Yeah. For example, last weekend, every single dish I did, the four dishes I did, were all either veggie or vegan.
Yeah.
Because that was the demand. So I've made a point from early doors of doing telly that I want to make sure if I'm going to cook with guests that I have to cook something that they're going to eat.
Yeah. There's a really kind of easy anti-plant eating line within comedy, within stand-up, but also there's some amazing stuff coming through now.
Well, the hard thing about it is, from my point of view, is that, you know, we're a popular show.
Yeah.
You know, we are Sunday mornings.
Yeah.
You know, so my son's mates who are 15 watch it, my mum and dad's friends who are in their 80s watch it, and everybody in between. And there are times when I feel editorially, I start doing recipes for five people.
And you're like, these five people do not represent any of the people watching this.
And
they're all being all fashion-y, and it's fashion-y to be vegan.
You fall into two roles. You fall into either the Great British Menu end of it, which is, look how clever I am as a chef, I've got amazing skill, you'll never be able to do this, I'm incredible.
Yeah.
Or you fall into sort of my end of it, and, you know, Jamie Oliver being at the forefront of all that, saying, listen, cooking's really good fun, it's really easy, get yourself in the kitchen, go to the supermarket, buy the stuff and cook some nice food. And I think if we're not careful, we are a little bit in danger that editorially I'm shifting too much to catering or cooking for five people rather than the million people who watch it.
Yeah.
And I don't know how we solve it, because obviously I still want my guests to feel welcomed.
No, it's bonkers, isn't it? That is a fascinating thing, and I hadn't even contemplated that when I thought of that question. It was watching it last week.
Yeah.
Exactly that. I'm thinking, God, in our world, everybody's going that way. But is it indicative? I feel like every time there's an election, I realise, oh no, I was in this bubble of people who all thought exactly the same thing as me, and they're like, no, that's not what the rest of the world's thinking at all.
But I think that outside of food, I think that's the problem with all of us in the media, full stop.
Yeah.
We live in this remarkable little bubble where the world is lovely, because we all actually have quite a lovely life, if truth be told. You know, and then when we have absolute nuts, abject surprise of something like Brexit happens, and you think, how did that happen? But then,
because a lot of people are really unhappy, and they're really desperate for a change, and it doesn't mean that they're stupid, and it doesn't mean it's just
completely agree.
Desperation.
Yeah, and I think also that, you know, they've been let down by us kind of left wing media lovies who sort of say everything's great, isn't it great, they want recovery, but we're in that kind of, you know, educated sheltered world where we're all kind of like doing our thing, whereas,
and we're in big cities as a rule where diversity is working.
Absolutely true. You know, I did an awards ceremony up in Aberdeen for the British fishing industry a couple of years ago, and it shocked me but for no reason other than the fact that, because I live in a media bubble, it shocked me, the difference of opinion from what I felt. And as a host of an award ceremony, I died on my backside. Because all the funny things that I said, they really weren't funny to a massive load of Aberdeen fishermen.
You're not a tiny chap yourself. I like the idea that there's these great big imposing... I want to try a smoked almond.
So smoked almonds are one of the greatest joys in modern life.
Really?
Because what they do is...
They smell amazing. It smells like I've been allowed to put my nose right in a fire.
Yeah. And that's what you want. A good smoked almond, or anything smoked, I think is good. But with an almond, you get that crunch, you get that saltiness. Then that umami sensation in your mouth is amazing. And they're great. You put them in a salad. Yeah. You make a pesto with them. You drink them with a little glass of cold sherry.
Yeah.
You have them with a gin and tonic.
I was going to say that's perfect with a gin and tonic. Yeah. It's a boiling hot day.
Yeah.
And there's something... The sun's finally calming down.
There's something amazing about them. And the first time I had them, I was in Spain. And I love Spanish food. I think Spanish food is probably my favourite food.
Is it?
Yeah, I think so. And Spanish just do the most amazing things with pigs. I think that, you know, their ability to kind of do like your chorizos and your slow cooked stuff, etc., etc. And almonds, pork products, like you have a little bit of slice of chorizo, you have some amazing Iberico
chorizo
ham.
Chorizo is something that makes me think there might be a God. Like, yeah. It's one of the divides between atheism and agnosticism for me. And I don't eat meat anymore. But I'm not, do you know what I mean? I'm not a vegan because I can't live my life thinking that I will never eat chorizo again. Like,
yeah.
But at the moment, I'm not eating meat. But, I mean, it's just a glorious thing. To put that thing with those spices?
Heavenly. It is just absolutely heavenly.
And then
you add the smoked almond into that. You go, if you chorizo, smoked almonds, Iberico ham, black pudding, glass of sherry.
Sweet sherry.
Yeah.
Cold. Really cold.
Really cold.
Oh, God. But also, I think what's amazing about these almonds is it is like being at a barbecue. You've got everything that's amazing about a barbecue in a mouthful.
Yeah, it's heavenly. It's just a delightful little piece.
Even a fruitarian can probably eat that.
No, because they're cooked.
Oh, they are. They're not raw.
They've been cooked above, is it 32 degrees? 60 degrees?
I can't remember.
Yeah.
They're so good.
Aren't they? Delicious.
Amazing. And like, incredibly subtly filling.
Yeah.
You find out later. So on your show, you have guests helping with your food prep. And I mean, you might not be allowed to say, but I'm really keen to know if anyone's ever been so useless. Because I think that's a risk. I found just even with the few people I've spoken to for this podcast so far, that there are people that cook and there are people who don't cook. And there's people who would want to if they have time. So there is a middle ground, but the people that don't cook, like, I wouldn't want to put a knife in their hands to even chop a bit of herbs while I want to know if anyone's ever been so useless that they've actually genuinely fucked what you were cooking.
I think one of my favourite times ever was quite early doors, probably about 10 years ago, with Mark Watson.
Love Mark Watson.
And Mark Watson describes himself as severely left-handed. And we tried to get Mark to zest a lemon. And he just couldn't do it. I think it's probably still up on YouTube if you get the chance.
Okay.
To see. And if you ever see Mark,
I'm
going to
find
remember
it and put it in the podcast.
It's honestly, it's one of the greatest moments of awkwardness you could ever imagine. Somebody not being able to. I mean, zesting lemons is good. Because then equally, we had Richard Blackwood on the show,
right?
Who Richard sort of said, "Oh, you need to zest lemon." And he goes, "Yeah, I know what I'm doing. So then Richard, who was a lovely guy, I've got to say, was a really great guest.
Yeah.
He cut the lemon in half and then tried to grate the flesh of the lemon. But by holding the lemon and moving the grater.
No!
And so the next day he was filmed, and it just went viral. It was one of those moments of telly where you go, this is just incredible. The next day when he went to EastEnders, they'd nailed lemons to his dressing room door. And to this day he still gets grief about it.
Good!
Brilliant.
Oh, man.
See, but then the other thing you get sometimes, and it tends to be bands. If you get a youngish band on who are trying to be cool, and I know when they walk into the kitchen area that they don't cook and they think it's not cool to cook. So they kind of stand
slightly with their right hip pushing forward,
and with
one hand in their pocket, and they almost don't make contact with the counter. Almost as if, like, you know, yeah, if I don't actually acknowledge this, it will just go away.
Just going to tell
I don't mind it. I think the thing is, because we've been doing it for so long,
you can tell now it's a pretty well-oiled machine that you're like, just chop that. And you can, when, even when people are like, do you need this smaller than that? You're like, it'll do.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't actually give you any responsibility. You can relax.
And I think the thing as well is that I think that it's that thing, I think as you get older, that you realise that being cool is a very different thing to what I think it is when you're in your 20s. So if you're a young man in your 20s, you think, oh my God, this is so uncool, chopping an onion. Meanwhile, everyone at home is watching the show going, get stuck in
that every day.
I want to see you kind of doing this. Well, they don't do it. They actually look very uncool rather relax into it, and it's kind of, it's one of those you want to sort of say to them, I'd rather you didn't do anything, or don't say you don't want to do a cook.
Do
it.
I'm in my time.
Do you still love cooking at home, or does that just feel like a busman's holiday?
Love it. I really, really
and
love
even
it.
Thinking of things.
You see, because my wife cooks as well. Because Ali used to be a chef. So she's a really good cook. My son Hamish is 15. He likes to cook. So when I'm cooking at home, I do really like it. So, for example, this weekend, then there's just Hamish and I at home. So tomorrow we can't decide if we're going to go out or we're going to eat in. But if we're going to stay in, then I want to try and get hold of some monkfish tomorrow, because I know he really likes monkfish. So yeah, I kind of do. So I know that tomorrow,
you've got a 15-year-old son that could cook monkfish.
Yeah,
I mean that is amazing.
He's
one of the hardest things I've ever. What I'm saying is, I've repeated it.
Monkfish is really easy to cook.
Is it?
You treat it like meat because it's a big, white, meaty fish.
Yeah.
Prepping it properly is the hard thing.
Oh, is it?
Just making sure that you get all that grey membrane off, because the membrane is so strong, and it'll take a load of heat on monkfish. It will curl up and become really tight, and it's really horrible to eat. So if you buy it from a decent fisherman, get them to take all the membrane off. Even if you say, listen, I'll pay you the weight with the membrane, then take it off for me.
That makes sense.
And so I do. I think about it in a different way. I think it's fun cooking at home. I mean, we tend to have a lot of people eating at our house all
the
time.
That's nice.
Yeah. I mean, it's very sociable, our house. Yeah.
Your kids' friends or just
kids' friends,
friends,
our friends,
family.
Random people who will just end up coming to our house and staying, and then we kind of feed them. So,
that's lovely. Was your house like that when you were growing up?
No, not really. I mean, my mum and dad are both brilliant cooks.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my mum's an amazing cook. She's still a really fantastic cook. And my dad cooked, which I think is kind of, when I was growing up, then in the 70s, then people's dads didn't really cook. You know, it was still, even though, you know, parents were both going to work, it was still very much the domain of, it was women's work. Yeah, my dad has always done the Sunday roast. My dad is happy to kind of, like, you know, cook dinner at any time. Still now, as an 85-year-old man, then he'll still, and he still cooks the best fried egg sandwich in the history of the world.
Nice.
So I think I was always surrounded by, we had a really sort of small, tight family, but we weren't full of kind of randoms like our houses.
Do you have siblings?
My sister's 3 years older than me. And she lives in Manchester too.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, so, great. You know, so I cook for her because she's a terrible cook.
So you did design before you did cooking, but was there already, I suppose if you had both parents cooking when you were growing up, it's already a pretty rare, like you're saying, an exciting thing to have had a male role model that was cooking when you were a kid. So were you into cooking even in your childhood? Show you stuff.
Yeah. I mean, we used to do cookery at school. So
was it any good though? My cookery at school was bad.
It's all right, actually. I think it was okay.
Great.
And I always liked that. And I think, and when I was a student, I worked in bars and restaurants.
Right.
So I think it was always there. In the
kitchen in bars.
No,
and
I was only
ever
front of house.
Waitressing. Yeah.
Yeah, but I always loved food. I've always loved food. Yeah. I think, you know, and I think my kids have been brought up liking good food, even though we're tiny. If you go somewhere the food is dreadful, my kids would leave rubbish food.
Really?
Which I kind of quite like.
That's cool. Yeah. I mean, it says that they've had, like, the best
like
options. Do you know what I mean? If you're like, nah, I'm not into
exactly,
that.
Yeah, not really interested, isn't really good. So yeah, so I don't think it was ever a surprise I've ended up doing what I'm doing.
Great.
I think also I was never a very good designer, so I think I had to do something that I was good at.
We were talking before we started recording, like, I felt like a bit of a wanker because you were saying, where did you go to uni? And I was like, oh, I went to LSE, did law, but I'd have made a shocking lawyer. I'm so, I just don't have a temperament for it, I think.
But I think
if I had a really good opposition that really kept their cool. I was thinking about it like watching the football. We, I should say, have met up just after England have won their quarterfinal of the World Cup, which is amazing. It's so exciting. But the Colombia match, I was sort of watching that going, I mean, we're all talking about how I just cannot believe how well they kept their heads in the face of such a leery opposition. I'd have had a red card within 10 minutes.
But I think that the thing with uni for me is that, oh, I went to poly rather than uni because I'm that old. I think that
it's a uni that, now though, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think that whole thing about further education, I think I'm the person I am because I went to do higher education.
Yeah.
And, you know, back when I did it, then you got all your fees paid and you got a grant. So it meant that there were loads of kind of working class kids. You know, my two best mates in the world, my two mates, Phil and Martin, who I was at uni with, and we've all done fine through that opportunity of being able to do it. Whereas, like, my daughter has now just finished her first year at uni, and there is one kid who is from a working class background, and you sort of think that opportunity, you know, when you've got fees to pay and accommodation to pay, you've got to have parents who can afford to do that. It's tragic.
I went when it was still £3,000 a year, so the reason I've still got a load of debt is because I'm very slow at paying off, and I've been self-employed, so it's been chipped away at. Cut that out. But like, or maybe not. I think I don't think I've done anything illegal. But it's complete. I mean, I think the year I left uni, it went up to £9,000 a year, and then just the more expensive you make it, less people that can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, I think, for a lot of people. So, of the people I've spoken to so far who have taught themselves cookery, who didn't have good influences at home, it is being thrown into the bear pit at uni.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have got amazing stories about the shit they ate because they still couldn't cook, all the disasters they had, and that in itself is a rite of passage.
Well, when we started Greens, I think we did that.
Did you?
Yeah, because I could
some big disasters.
I could cook like a student could cook.
Yeah.
But I couldn't cook veggie food that was, you know, going out to the marketplace that people would buy. So we cooked a load of crap.
Did you? It's an awful thing.
Just like things that were over seasoned, over spicy, terrible textures, dreadful combinations. I think because I'm quite obsessive, then I just wanted to be as good as I could be.
Yeah.
So I used to go to market every morning.
Really?
I used to market at 5 o'clock every morning to learn about produce.
Amazing.
And then we'd write a menu every day, which is a ridiculous thing to do.
Every day a different menu?
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh my gosh.
Because I thought that was what you should do. I
mean,
I
think obviously works. Like it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I flipped out a bit, really, because I think in the first 2 years, I gave up alcohol, coffee, and having a life, basically, just to kind of learn about kind of food. I had this ridiculous notion that if I drank coffee, it diminished my ability to taste things. I think tasting is quite an important thing when you want to learn to cook.
Yeah.
So I thought if I give up alcohol and coffee and I just drank water, then I would be able to kind of like taste in a better way. I think it was flipping out.
Hello, I'm just interrupting myself here to say that if you're up at the Edinburgh Festival right now and you're listening to this before the 25th of August, I'm doing one gig only up there, and it's part of the amazing Secret Policeman's Ball. It returns. It's two shows are on the 24th and the 25th. I'm on the 25th. The Guilty Feminists are putting these on, and they're for Amnesty International. It's at the Edinburgh Playhouse. The lineups are off the scale amazing. It's for a stunning cause, so if you can get there, please do get there. Thank you.
I was genuinely working 100 hours a week.
Oh.
So, you know, it was...
I mean, that's a bit bold, isn't it? But did you have a breakdown? What stopped you?
I think
you
not
that?
Far off. Yeah, I mean, I really, really do.
That's someone working too hard, taking it all too seriously for a human being that only gets one life.
I used to black out.
God.
So I used to, I would go home from work, and I'd get back from work about 12, and I had to be at market for 5.
Yeah.
And then I'd find myself kind of just kind of coming round on my knees thinking, I don't quite know what happened then. And then I'd just kind of, then I'd get up and go to market a few hours later. So yeah, I mean, I think I was in a really dark place, you know, I really, really do. But unaware of it, I just thought it was tight, and I was. I mean, I was absolutely, utterly exhausted. But I think my thought processes got a little bit weird.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it took 2 years to kind of get through that.
That's amazing. Did you have to get through that on your own? Did you get some help?
Well, I think, I mean, I didn't have any
I have loads
any
of therapy.
Proper help. I didn't
hands
have any
up,
therapy or anything.
Up.
But I had a good support mechanism
right,
around
good.
Me. And Simon, my business partner at Greens, you know, we're still really, really close friends now. And you know, in that 2 year period, I split up with my long term girlfriend. I lost about 2 stone.
Oh.
I stopped socialising, blah, 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 blah.
Well, a question that I always ask everyone that I talk to on this podcast is, have you always had a good relationship with eating? But I suppose actually, if you've ever had a patch, I think of being overwhelmed or of being ill is the best way of putting it, really.
I think
you can classify it as that now. Whatever took you to that point, it almost always affects your eating, doesn't it? Or is the main symptom of it ends up being?
Yeah, I mean,
you lost a lot of weight in that time.
Yeah, I mean, I think I lost a lot of weight because I was working 100 hours
yeah,
a week.
Exactly.
And I think also.
Time, isn't it?
Because, I mean, chefs are notorious. When you work in a kitchen all the time, you know, notoriously don't eat but taste all day, so you never
really?
Think you're hungry. So you're constantly having an almond, so you'll taste a smoked almond,
yeah.
Then you'll taste some soup, then you'll taste a chocolate brownie, then you'll taste a curry.
Yeah.
So your body is constantly going, yep, you've had a bit of food. Which is why chefs get ulcers, because you don't eat. You just,
stomach ulcers.
Yeah, so you just taste. And then you don't really ever kind of satisfy that hunger, really.
I had never thought about this. So I'm sort of doing work with a therapist at the moment about how human body is meant to have something, a bit of protein and then other nutrients, but like every couple of hours, and meals, like, but you shouldn't really go for long, long stretches of time unless you're doing like an overnight fast or
yeah.
whatever. And it's just so interesting. I'd never thought about how that must be for a chef's life. So what I'm trying to do for the first time ever, really, other than when it's been very unconscious, whenever I've been travelling, I've realised, and my first year at uni, whenever I've been in a routine or away from my routine, in the very extremes from normality, I've always been able to be a lot more intuitive about when I'm hungry, when I'm full. I feel it's a very hot day. I'm not particularly hungry today. It's a boiling hot day.
Yeah.
Sweaty, full of adrenaline, we had the football, then this is fun. So it's just sort of listening to yourself. So actually, if you're a chef, there is no more confusing a time to try and be intuitive and listen to when you're hungry, listen to when you're full. Because on top of that, tasting all day, so constant little bits of
always.
Salt, sugar, constantly.
Always. And you drink so much coffee.
Yeah, the coffee to keep it going. And the
yeah.
adrenaline.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Adrenaline knocks everything
yeah.
out of whack
yeah.
as to whether you're...
Yeah, big time, and it is. I mean, it's you know, we weren't in any way, shape, or form a brutal kitchen. You know, we were 28 cup of vegetarian restaurant. You know,
yeah.
there's not a lot of aggression in those kind of circumstances. And basically, we couldn't afford to be playboys, so there was really only me. But you are still in that zone of just kind of, you know, you it's just it's very, very weird.
So weird. So, but how do you manage that now? Because you still have an extremely busy life.
Yeah, I don't stand at a stove all day anymore.
No.
I knew I needed to stop doing that 12 years ago. So
right.
I was 13 years ago, I was 42. I remember the night. So it's when we had 3 places then, and my telly crew just sort of started to do a little bit of stuff. And I remember a Friday night, and I'd sort of been doing other stuff all day. Then I came into the kitchen at 5 o'clock, and really, really busy Friday night. And at the end of it, and I thought, I hated every minute of that. I really hated feeling on the brink of being out of control, because my head had been in a different place during the day. Then I came in and I was kind of like, and I was still doing that, you know, 5 nights a week. And I realised that I needed to stop doing that, because I didn't want to become that bitter chef that hated customers, hated service, hated my team, became angry with the front of house staff. I thought, right, I need to kind of change this, because if I'm not careful, I'll do that. And it took me probably 3, maybe 4 years to fully remove the necessity for me to do it, but yeah. I knew that I had to, and it was the right move, you know, because I think it made me fall back in love with restaurants again, because I think it was
a lot of restaurants. From it, you're right up in your face,
yeah,
relentlessness of it,
yeah.
But again, that's not something short of a breakdown and actually being forced away from it for a brief patch of time, which it also doesn't cure. It does take years to disentangle yourself from something because you're so invested in it as well. Like,
yeah,
not just money, that's your everything.
Well, that's the other thing, you know, the reality being that, you know, when we have three sites, it's very hard for me to say, right, you know what, I still want to earn the same money I'm drawing from this business, but I don't want to actually be working 56 hours a week in this kitchen. So how do we get to that point? And, you know, I end up taking a pay cut to enable me to do it, and I sort of gradually weaned myself off it, and it was the best thing I did.
And it's about, isn't it, release and control, delegation, trust,
yeah big
building
time,
building up a team of amazing people.
But it's incredibly liberating.
It doesn't happen overnight.
It's really, really liberating when you allow yourself to say, right, I can no longer be inward facing and it being a reflection of me, and you sort of go, right, listen, you know, you're my head chef now, listen, have your legs, go for it, you know, I'll back you, and let's sort of see what happens. And you also realise as well that when you let somebody have that responsibility, as long as you treat them well as an employee and they trust you and they like working for you, they want to show you that they can do a brilliant job. And I think I was very fortunate that's what happened. You know, I had a really great team of people who just sort of said, this is amazing, look what we're doing. Just go, wow, you know, it's kind of, I would never approach it in that way, but what you're doing is really successful and it really works. And it was incredibly liberating.
I love it. What an amazing, happy story, really.
Yeah.
Out of all that, I think there's something very satisfying about hearing about this graft and then this freedom into being able to relax and enjoy the fruits of your graft, really.
Yeah.
Not that you ever, I'm not saying that you're not working as hard now, but you choose the areas. You choose where to focus your energies.
Oh, yeah. I now have the job that I want rather than the job that I have to have. And I think that's a really lovely place to be. And every now and again, then I have to have the job that I've got to do. You know, if push comes to shove, then I'll still stand at the stove and I'll still kind of cook all day. I suppose the difference between now is that if there's a problem in one of the sites now, I'm a long way down the list of people to phone to cover a shift. You know, it's a proper desperation.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but listen, I'm really sorry, but you're on site and you know what? Somebody's not shown up and we've got 84 booked for lunch and I've got a really experienced team. Any chance you could run a section? You go, yeah, of course I will. But yeah, it is a nice place to be, definitely.
Get in.
Delicious.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare tri-term medical plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you did Strictly,
yeah.
Now that is serious business. Did you have to go on into eating like an athlete for that?
I eat pretty well, really.
Yeah.
Because I exercise loads anyway. So I actually probably ate more junk when I did Strictly.
Did you? Because it was because of the hours you were keeping?
6 hours a day, 26 hours a day, 5 days a week. I've been active all of my life and I've never trained that much.
Really?
Ever. So you can just eat whatever you want.
Yeah. I suppose if that is 6 hours of sweating hard.
Yeah. And you
cardio.
Need carbs.
And it's everything, isn't it? Strength, cardio, it's everything.
Everything. Yeah, it's why, you know, Karen, who is my dance partner, I could never believe how much she ate on a daily basis.
It's a joyous thing to
hear. And there's just nothing of her, and she's strong and she's fit, she's amazing. But it's our thing, but you know, it's your full time job.
Yeah.
Dancing was my full time job.
Was it fun?
Honestly, it was so brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, because I thought if I could get past week one, I'd be happy. So I got to week six. So
it's amazing.
I did really love it. It's the most terrifying thing I've ever done as well.
Really?
Terrifying. Because as we get older, we stand outside of our comfort zone so much less.
Yeah.
And you are out of it every second of every day.
I don't feel like you are, though. I mean, I think that is a huge challenge. I mean, I'd be terrified to go like, okay, entirely new skill set that people spend their entire lives crafting.
But the first one that you do, right, so the first dance that I did, the Paso Doble, and I'm standing on a box in the first show, and they are dancing the Paso Doble, Simon Rimmer and Karen Clifton, and you cannot hear the music. All you can genuinely hear is your heart just absolutely pounding in your ear.
I'm stressed out just imagining it.
And if somebody comes to me at that point, go, listen, you have to do this. You get off the box, put your coats, you go home, you go, I'll do that. I'll take that. Thank you, I'll take that. But it was brilliant.
5 second rule, yes or no?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's upsetting. Light.
It's more germs on your floor than you go, why would you do it?
What's really, really worrying is of everyone I've spoken to, it's only been the doctor and the chef who've said, no, that's disgusting.
Yeah.
And everyone's gone, yes, 10 minute rule.
Yeah, I do it for myself.
Oh, no, I don't mean you'd serve it to someone you were looking for.
No, I would do it for myself, yeah, gotcha.
Oh, 5 second rule for you, that's what I mean.
Probably 24 hours.
Oh, fine! Oh, okay. And for your own children, I've got a 2-year-old, and I basically eat him.
Absolutely fine.
Sometimes he crawls into the stairwell of the car underneath where his seat is and nibbles things.
Yeah, that's fine. I don't mind that at all. I've cut a piece of steak around where the cat had kind of started licking it.
Perfect. Okay.
That's fine. Yeah, I don't have a problem with myself. No.
I drew the line today where he'd left most of his lunch and I'd seen there were 3 flies on it. I thought, I will bit.
Would you go with 2?
Yeah, it would have been fine with 2.
Three is just too many.
Just a bit of fly juice.
Yeah.
They're not that dirty. Flies are not famously that disgusting. got a hangover? What's your go-to thing?
I'll have salt and vinegar crisps, a banana, and an Eccles cake.
Salt and vinegar crisps, a banana, and an Eccles cake.
Yeah.
In that order?
It doesn't really matter on the order.
Salt and vinegar crisps. I can't believe no one said salt and vinegar crisps until now.
It's a fantastic hangover cure. The vinegar just gives you a little bit of a zip in there as well.
I once had a hangover and needed salt and vinegar crisps so badly, I had to do quite a large detour to a services just to get some salt and vinegar crisps.
I can go for that.
What's your favourite salt and vinegar crisp?
I do like a Walker's, although historically they're different now. Marks and Spencer's salt and vinegar crisps used to be the best, but they're not. They've changed the recipe now, so I will go Walker's.
I think I'm going to counter that with the. What about? Have you ever had a Disco salt and vinegar crisp?
Oh, no.
Okay, can I just put that out there as something?
So the chicken will leave your mouth off.
Yeah, basically.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's a sign of good salt and vinegar crisps.
Shapes,
yeah.
And they're just, it's a potency.
That's
thing,
good, I like that.
And then McCoy's, I think, are off that.
Yeah, really I don't good. Mind McCoy's. But no, I do like a good Walker's, is fine.
But in line with your M&S pension, I think that their fake Watsits are better than real Watsits. They're cheesy puffs.
Really?
I just think they must make them with nicer cheese dust. whatever
do they
the
stain your fingers in quite the same way?
Not quite the same way. The best I've ever... Have you ever eaten a cheesy flavour crisp in America where they don't have the rules on colourings and E-numbers?
In the bright yellow. Yeah.
You get like
crisp,
Montgomery Burns hands, been dunked in nuclear, nice. Something glowing
that,
fingers
I do.
Would do.
The States do all junk food better than we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, they really do. They'll never
by
have
better, we
tax.
Mean worse. But yeah, no, they won't ever have a sugar
never
going to
happen.
Nor will we after Brexit, by the sounds of it. Not if we make a trade deal with them on the food front. I could ask you a question from one of my listeners, Rosie Johnson. So she's put it like this. Would you rather eat one really exceptional meal a month, the rest being bland but nutritious, or fine meals every day but never anything wonderful? So I think
that's a good question.
It is a good question, and I think perhaps it comes down to a broader question of how often do you think of food as something special, and how often do you think of it as fuel, I suppose.
I reckon I'd probably go 5 specialty fuel on days.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there'll be a couple of days when it becomes functional if I'm really busy.
Yeah.
And if I'm driving, yeah, we've got, you know, I'll do about 500 miles a week minimum go between sites. So if it's kind of like, God, I haven't eaten, then, yeah, right, you'll stop at a service station, you'll buy a bland sandwich, and then you'll have, you know, a bland crisps. Oh. Yeah, so, but generally speaking, I think it's always special. And also, I have access to nice food all the time.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I suppose that's, you're a terrible person for me to have asked this question. Only because you've got special food around you.
But from choice, tonight. From choice. If I didn't have that option, I think I'd have to go on fine but not exceptional.
Yeah, really?
I just think, when you eat bland food, because I think about food all the time. Yeah. I think if you had more of it just being bland, I think it would really get me down.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, yeah. I haven't thought about it in the context of... I think about food all the time as well, but I also really enjoy thinking about food.
Yeah,
all the time.
I do,
so,
yeah.
Actually, if you were like... I don't know, I don't want to take that joy away of kind of the planning of the thing. And I don't care that sometimes it means it didn't actually taste as good as the idea of it was.
Yeah, I agree.
It just, yeah... God, what a complicated question, Rosie. Well
good.
Done.
I like
really
it. Good question.
It.
Good really good question.
Question. What's the weirdest thing you've ever eaten?
If not the weirdest, the thing that I really didn't want to eat, but I did.
Ooh,
I ate smoked whale.
Was that for a TV thing?
Well, basically, I was filming in Bergen in Norway, and we're at the marketplace. We weren't filming this particular bit. And I just saw this kind of stuff at this little counter and said, what's that? And they said, smoked whale. And said, here, try a bit. And it's sort of that, and obviously, you know, the kind of the bit that goes, no, I don't want to do this because I don't believe in whaling, blah, blah, blah. But you go, and there's something to say. You think, well, I'm not going to be able to save that whale. It
no,
is already dead, and it's smoked, and I'm a chef, and I'm intrigued by flavours. So, and as I'm putting this thing to my mouth, thinking, what am I going to do if this is the most amazing flavour I've ever had in my life? Would it change?
Yeah.
What if it, and it was disgusting.
Was it?
Yeah, it tasted like a smoked eraser.
Like a rubber?
Yeah. The texture was exactly that.
Really?
Yeah, just but
like
smoky.
That hard?
Yeah, it's horrible.
Oh dear.
Yeah, but that afternoon, that was in the morning, in that afternoon, I interviewed
it's
a guy.
You know that now.
Yeah. Which makes it even more reason to kind of, you know, to be against it. Then that afternoon, we filmed with a guy in a whaling museum, and I was there full of indignation, come on, you know, even up to now. And now, no, this is absolutely wrong.
Yeah.
So I'm there, like, reading all these questions. And so tell me, what is it with you Norwegians eating whale? And he goes, Simon, let me say, we just fucking love the taste. And you've got nowhere to go. But does he go, oh, you know, from a chef's point, you go, oh, okay, and then you will go, but it's wrong,
you haven't pretended.
You
put your hands up. There's no moral justification for this. I just think it tastes. I really like smoky rubbers.
Yeah.
I went to Norway and had some dried yak.
Oh, was that nice?
No, disgusting.
Sounds it.
It was in like a yurt. It was over like between Christmas and New Year. It was all snowy and in a yurt. And it was, and you'd take it like in a strip as energy food if you were going on a trek up to try and see the Northern Lights. But also, it's that thing of being like, I'm going to be adventurous. I want to taste this thing. But it just tasted like the idea of it, what a yak would be.
I'm
all right.
Yeah, no, I
but
believe
I did,
that.
I had this little part of me that goes, but I went there for one taste.
Yeah.
I don't think the issue is with everyone wanted to try a thing once.
Yeah.
This is an odd one. If there was nothing else left in the world, would you eat a person?
Yeah. Absolutely no problem at all.
I take so much joy out of when people answer that question really quickly and decisively, so I must make my day. Have you got any specific hopes for technology in the future? I just think things are moving so quickly, we've mentioned that, but like technology, 3D printing, as a chef, is there any that must have affected how you work in your kitchens? I mean, sous vide-ing, all those chefs' kind of tricks that are making their way into other kitchens, like, you know, accessible stuff. How do you feel about technology?
I love them. I think it's an exciting time, really. You know, there's probably about kind of growing food. You know, we waste so many resources producing food, which doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So there has to be an alternative. I'm not saying that all of a sudden we won't ever farm cows and we won't kind of have cow beautifully 32-day aged pieces of beef.
Yeah.
But I think there have to be other alternatives for our protein intake.
Yeah.
You know, the world can't produce enough food. So I think. And also, I think the technology, it works on two levels. One is from my point of view, you go, wouldn't it be great if you could produce, I don't know, things that take a long time. Say, chorizo, we talk about.
Yeah.
Say, all of a sudden, you can use a printer to produce chorizo that has the same quality. You can produce it instantly rather than letting it cure for 3 years. There'd be something quite exciting about that. Then I suppose on the other side, you think, well, if we can start producing food, then surely then, in terms of bigger issues, like poverty, hunger, etc., etc., then that's surely going to be...
Climate change and all of
that
stuff.
Yeah, that's surely going to be kind of a massive change.
I'm a big fan of synthetic meats for that reason, basically. If we can get away from all the stuff that farming's doing on a kind of a... just to the planet, aside from any animal kind of stuff, just to the temperature of the earth, if we could move farming back down to some kind of sensible scale and... But then I wonder how we manufacture the fake meat. But anyway, I find it very exciting that it's tasting more and more like meat.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because it's like the whole thing at the moment, straws are the enemy of the world.
Right.
Because they are genuinely polluting the oceans. So what we've done now is we're going back to saying, let's have paper straws, which kind of get rid of all the trees. And you kind of go, oh, right. And we get rid of all the trees, which adds to climate change. You go, okay, so how do we go? So technology, maybe the technology side of things is also kind of good from the way in which we consume food and eat food as much as it is producing it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's actually one of the biggest things that can happen.
Yeah, fascinating.
Say scrumdiddlyumptious.
No!
And then you can be in my podcast.
There's a bee plague heading to Earth from Mars on an asteroid, which would be the death of all bees, and so eventually starting quite an agonising apocalypse generally. But you are given a chance to stop it, and only you. To stop the asteroid, you need to fire a giant air cannon up at a specific point in space for 14 hours without a break, and it's really heavy. You do it! You're a hero! But you're really sweaty, you're very knackered, it's more physically exhausting than strictly. You're allowed a shower or whatever you want to feel human again, but your reward is the feast of your dreams. It can be entirely hypothetical. It doesn't have to be things that go together. I don't care about quantities unless that's relevant, but I want to know what you're eating, what you're drinking, where, and who with. And they don't even have to be people who are alive, they don't have to be people who you've ever met, etc.
So I'm going to be, location, I'm going to be in Del Mar, which is a little tiny seaside town just outside of San Diego, which is my happy place.
Amazing.
Which is probably my favourite place in the world. If I feel about somewhere I want to be that'll make me happy, that's
wow.
It. So I'm in Del Mar, I'm going to eat on a roof terrace overlooking the ocean, so it'll be right on the front line of the ocean. With me, this is really cliche, but I will have a wife and my two kids, and probably a selection, probably about 25 other friends. So we'll start off with a few bottles of Billy Cart Salmon Rosé Champagne to kind of get it going.
Billy Cart Salmon.
Yeah. So I'll start with that, and then I'll dip my finger into a jar of Skippy's smooth peanut butter. Which is the best peanut butter in the world. And I'll just eat and I'll just continue to have sticky fingers and just keep licking that just while I'm kind of just standing there basically.
Perfect.
There'll then be
what an aperitif. Can you do that in one of your swanky restaurants at some point? Have that as the thing, the little shot glass of, that comes out before the start.
The Skippy smooth peanut butter.
Oh yes.
Yeah. I'll start with that. Then there'll be pork pies for me to eat. But they won't be cut into quarters like you get when you get somewhere. They'll just be whole, so I just bite them.
Nice, like a pork pie tapas, like a mouth
Yeah.
Pork pie.
Yeah.
Yes or no to jelly in a pork pie?
I don't mind the jelly, as long as it's good jelly. But what I'd do is I wouldn't eat the whole pork pie at any point. What I'd do, I would have a bite of pork pie, maybe two, then I'd just leave it. Right, so I just drop it. it would just kind of, it would just be left.
It's just there.
Yeah. So once I've done that, then I'll have a selection of fine, varied ales, mainly kind of British IPAs. Probably Rooster's Yankee, which is probably my favourite beer in the world. I'd have that. So that's just to sort of start off. And then I'll probably go for a massively lavish Indian feast.
Oh, nice.
So we'd have Kingfisher Lager on draft. We'd have Papadom's chutney. It'd have to be really good quality lime pickle.
Yes, I was going to say, I wanted to hear the words lime pickle, and you said
that. I love lime pickle.
With whole chunks of lime
love
in
it. Love it. That really hurts.
Yes.
And then I'd have fish tikka. I'd have onion bhajis. I'd have meat samosas.
Fish tikka.
Yeah, fish tikka was so nice. And then for main courses, there'd be... I don't like plain pilau rice. I don't like almond rice. I don't really like boiled rice with my curry. I'd have plain naan because I don't like any of the flavoured naans either. And then I'd have sag lamb. No, I'm not a big garlic fan.
Oh, okay.
In its right setting, I don't mind it, but generally speaking, I think it's overused. As is balsamic vinegar.
Got it, yes.
As is dill. So I would have sag lamb. So lamb and spinach, but madras hot. I'd have chicken tikka masala, even though it isn't British, because I really love it. I'd have tandoori lamb chops. I'd have prawn puri. I would have Bombay potatoes. I would have tandoori quail.
Whoa.
So tandoori quail is a long-standing joke in our circles that we used to go to an Indian restaurant in Rusholme in Manchester after work on a Saturday night, and they used to have tandoori quail, but they never had it. It was just on the menu, you go, can we have tandoori quail? You just do it as a joke, oh, sorry, I've got any quail today. So I've never had tandoori quail. So
I would have to get your tandoori quail.
I'd probably also at some point there would also have to be some Iberico ham, because I do just love Spanish ham so much. There'd have to be that somewhere along the line, because that goes with Indian food. And then I'm not a massive dessert fan, so I'd maybe have a bit of cheesecake, because I do like a baked cheesecake, but have lots of cheese.
So I'd
have kind of Kirkham's Lancashire. I'd have Montgomery cheddar. I'd have some stinking bishop. I'd have a really kind of good varied cheese board.
Nice.
Lots of different biscuits, lots of good chutneys. And then I'd finish with a ridiculous amount of shots of coffee Patron vodka.
Lovely.
And that'll probably be quite a nice night.
Heaven. Yeah. I mean, it's an extensive list of heaven.
Massive loads of thanks to the lovely, kind, inimitable Simon Rimmer. What a dear man. I couldn't have felt more comfy talking to him in that regressively windy pub garden. You can see him all over the telly on Channel 4's Sunday Brunch every weekend. His inaugural restaurant, Greens in West Didsbury, is exactly where I'm headed next time I'm northwest. And you can follow his latest news and offerings on his social media, where he's at Simon Rim. Please tell everyone you can contact in the whole internet and your real lives about this smelly podcast. It's on all the socials as at The Hoovering Pod. Rate, review and subscribe. And follow me too, at Jessica Fostercue. I love it when you make contact with me. If you want to email me, you can do that through my website, jessicafostercue.com. Those of you sharing this podcast, those of you financially helping me out as patrons, those of you subscribing, those of you rating, reviewing, thank you, thank you, thank you. You are my lifeblood. Hoovering is produced by Emma Corsham, and the music is by Mike Greenway. Until next week, happy hoovering.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.